When it comes to fracked fossil fuels, are we being sold a bunch of snake oil?
The industry wants us to believe that we can have it all. We can have an abundance of fuel, we can have it at low cost, and we can have it for a long time. The U.S. can be energy independent. It's a great story, but the data just don't back it up. It's just not true.
That's energy analyst Richard Heinberg. We talked to him about his riveting new book, Snake Oil, How Fracking's False Promise of Plenty Imperils Our Future. And journalist Bill McKibben helped spark the global mass movement to save the climate.
I wrote the first book about climate change, I guess, about 25 years ago, a book called The End of Nature. And I think at the time, I assumed, and I think most people assumed, that given all this information, given the fact that our finest scientists were trotting up to Capitol Hill every year to explain what was going on, eventually action would happen, that was how our systems work. But that turns out not to be how our system works, at least in this case. The financial power of the fossil fuel industry was so great that it was necessary to try and build some kind of countervailing power. We're not going to outspend Exxon, obviously, so we have to find other currencies to work in, the currencies of movements, passion, spirit, creativity.
McKibben tells the story of how the climate movement has developed and a parallel story of his neighbor in rural Vermont, who just happens to be a master beekeeper. McKibben's latest book is Oil and Honey, The Education of an Unlikely Activist. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. As deadly flooding continues to devastate Colorado, an environmental disaster is brewing. Highly toxic fracking fluids from the state's many installations for oil and gas extraction are spreading over the flooded landscape. Colorado is one of the nation's centers for what is being touted as the U.S. Saudi Arabia, the vast stores of oil and natural gas trapped in tight formations underground that were impossible to get to until the development of new fracking technologies. The fracking boom is being called our ticket to energy independence, cheap fuel far into the foreseeable future, a bridge to the coming renewable energy economy, a job creation machine, and a savior to cash-strapped farmers and rural communities. In other words, a panacea to all that ails us. But is it a panacea or snake oil? My guest, Richard Heinberg, is a leading expert on the economic and ecological impacts of fossil fuels. Starting with his book, The Party's Over, Heinberg has written 11 books about why we need to get off fossil fuels and transition to safer, cleaner renewables fast. His latest, Snake Oil, is a gripping, fact-filled, but eminently readable book examining how the fracking boom ain't all it's cracked up to be. While natural gas prices have plummeted recently, Heinberg says that's due to an unsustainable bubble in drilling and is likely to be over by 2020. And those behind the gas boom are some of the same Wall Street banks that crashed the economy in 2008. Meanwhile, the public is being sold on an industry that threatens to poison water supplies forever, explode global temperatures, and devastate the communities hosting its operations. Heinberg bases his predictions and analysis on the industry's own calculations and on robust studies by U.S. government scientists. He's senior fellow in residence at the Post Carbon Institute in California. Well, this is just a terrific book. Richard Heinberg, welcome to Writer's Voice. You've been a proponent of the idea of peak oil, that is the idea that we've entered a period of decreasing supplies of oil. And when I say idea, I don't mean that there's anything wrong with it, but that this has been a controversial concept. And it's especially come under attack over the past 2 years as fracking has opened up gas and oil to new exploration and supplies. You tackle this question head on right at the top of the book, and you talk about two teams, the Cornucopians and the Peakists, of which you were in the latter team. Tell us about these two teams, and first tell us about the Cornucopians. Who are they, and what are they saying?
The word cornucopian comes, of course, from the mythic horn of plenty, the cornucopia. And their view is that Earth's resources are immense, and particularly when it comes to oil, there are vast amounts of oil out there left to extract, and so we really don't have to worry about any kind of oil supply constraints. And that's in contrast to we peakists who have been led, I guess you could say, by the work of a small informal group of retired and independent petroleum geologists who've been saying for about the last 15 years now that the oil industry is headed into a new era, that the plentiful conventional oil that drove economic growth during the 20th century is depleting, and we're substituting unconventional oil that's harder and more expensive to access, and that's inevitably going to have economic consequences. And as a result, global oil production is, for both economic and geologic reasons, going to reach a peak sometime in the very near future and begin to decline. And I argue in the book that what we've seen over the past 10, 15 years actually strongly supports the peakist view.
Yeah, you marshal a number of different arguments. Where did you get your research from?
Specifically, this book comes from a study that my organization, Post Carbon Institute, commissioned. It's a study of 65,000 oil and gas wells that have been horizontally drilled and fracked over the past few years. We wanted to test the claim of the industry that the U.S. now has an abundance of shale gas and tight oil, so that we have 100 years of cheap natural gas, and the U.S. is about to surpass Saudi Arabia as the world's foremost oil producer, and we may be even exporting oil in the years ahead. These are the claims that the industry is making right now, and they're making those claims in radio and TV ads, newspapers and magazines, and those same claims are being parroted by policymakers and politicians all across the country. We thought this was a really important point of fact to get straight, so we wanted to see what the numbers really were. We bought rights to the data on all of these wells, including the initial production rates over the first 5 years or however long the wells had been in existence, the geography of the wells, where they were located. And what we learned was that in each of the geographic plays, rock formations where shale oil or shale gas is present, there's a small core area where production is prolific and profitable to the industry. These core areas may be a few counties in extent, as compared to some of these geographic plays are, you know, encompass more than one state. So the core areas are productive, but you get outside of those core areas and the initial production rates are much lower and they decline viciously, very, very rapidly. So if you drill a well in January, you might have a few million thousand cubic feet or a few million cubic feet of natural gas production from that well, but by December that production has declined by maybe 70 to 80%. So the industry has to drill more and more just to stay even, and the core areas are being drilled out very rapidly, which means that in all likelihood the claims that are being made are wildly exaggerated. Instead of 100 years of cheap natural gas, we will probably see U.S. natural gas production starting to decline before the end of this decade. Same with tight oil from the Bakken Formation in North Dakota and the Eagle Ford Formation in South Texas. These are bubbles. These are short-term booms that are set to decline quite soon and quite rapidly.
Wow. Now, the data that you have is industry data. Is that correct?
That is correct. The data is from a company called Drilling Info, which is located in Austin, Texas, and they collect drilling data that the companies themselves report to the Securities and Exchange Commission and also to to state and federal government.
So explain to me, if our gas supplies, and we're talking about gas right now, or about both fracked oil and gas?
That's correct, yes, both.
Okay. So when you're talking about 10 or fewer years of growing fuel supplies, and this is industry data, these industry folks are sinking millions, billions of dollars into this. What are they thinking of?
Well, what they're thinking of is making short-term profit. And we're not talking, for the most part, about the big oil companies like ExxonMobil, BP, Shell, and so on. We're talking about dozens of much smaller companies like Chesapeake, Devon, XTO, Range, and so on. These are companies that are highly leveraged. They got into the business to produce unconventional oil and gas. They developed the technology, hydrofracturing, the cocktails of chemicals like slickening agents and proppants. They developed horizontal drilling and brought all of these technologies together. So they've really done some amazing things, but they only have accomplished these things because they were working in the context of very high oil prices and natural gas prices. Back in the 2005 to 2008 period, we were seeing record oil prices, and still are actually, and very high natural gas prices, and that was an incentive for them to apply this expensive technology to developing low grade resources, because basically that's all we have left to produce in this country. We've already pretty much tapped out our conventional oil and gas. So now what's left is tar sands in Canada, deep water oil in the Gulf of Mexico, and these tight reservoirs where the rocks have very low permeability and low porosity. So it requires special technology like horizontal drilling and hydrofracturing to get the oil and gas out. So that's what they've done. And it's profitable to produce the liquids, the oil and natural gas liquids. But what's happened with natural gas is, regular natural gas, is that the producers have actually driven down the price below the cost of production. So this is an economic problem for the companies themselves.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with energy analyst and author Richard Heinberg about his latest book, Snake Oil: How Fracking's False Promise of Plenty Imperils Our Future. So that seems to be a sustainability problem in and of itself. I mean, is this problem just one that's going to go away but leave us with a huge amount of stranded assets and environmental destruction?
Well, yeah, the problem of low prices will go away. The industry's trying to fix that right now with natural gas exports. Prices of natural gas are much higher in Europe, Japan, and South Korea. So if the U.S. can export natural gas to these places, then that will actually drive the price of natural gas domestically up very significantly. We're talking about prices. Just a few years ago, the natural gas price in the U.S. was in the range of $12 a thousand cubic feet, and that's in the neighborhood of the prices that we're seeing in Japan, South Korea, and Europe right now. Fracking has resulted in a temporary glut in the market, which has driven the price down to $3 to $3.50. Again, that's below the actual cost of production. The industry would like to see that price double or triple or even quadruple. But here's the thing. They've sold fracking as a way of providing America with cheap natural gas for decades to come. They've talked the utilities industry into switching from coal to burning more natural gas. The chemicals industry, which had fled the U.S. because natural gas prices were rising, the chemicals industry has come back. But now, if the natural gas industry raises prices, if they succeed in exporting natural gas, then that will drive the chemicals industry back to where they were, offshore. And it will result in utilities across the U.S. burning more coal and less natural gas. So all of the benefits that were promised will go away.
I mean, I understand from reading President Obama's, you know, all of the above strategy that he talked about after he got elected in the second term, you know, includes building these huge natural gas ports, but he's not telling the American people that that's going to lead to a rise in prices.
Right. You know, the industry wants us to believe that we can have it all. We can have an abundance of fuel, we can have it at low cost, and we can have it for a long time. The U.S. can be energy independent. It's a great story. People love happy stories like that. But the data just don't back it up. It's just not true. The reality is we can have more fuel, but at a very high price. And, you know, one way or another, we will be paying the cost in terms of environmental damage, because as we move to unconventional sources of oil and gas, whether we're talking about deep water or tar sands or shale gas, tight oil, the environmental risks are higher than we have been accustomed to in the past with regular conventional oil. It's inevitable. With fracking, for example, each well requires between 3 and 4 million gallons of water. So where does that water come from? That's a serious question in already water-stressed places like Texas or Oklahoma or Colorado or California. And then what happens to the water once it's done its job deep under the earth? It has to be brought back up. It contains, at this point, not only the chemicals that the industry mixed with it in order for it to do its job, but it also contains contaminants that it's brought up from deep underground, including heavy metals and minerals and radioactive nuclides. What do you do with that wastewater? Well, you can put it in containment ponds where it evaporates, but wildlife may have access to it. Or you can send it out to a water treatment plant that's completely unprepared to deal with the radioactivity. There are no good answers to these problems. And while there's been a lot of discussion about damage to water tables from bad well casings, and there are definitely documented instances of that, it's this problem of what to do with the wastewater from fracking that's really going to be devilish for a long time to come.
As we speak today, I was just listening to the news this morning that talked about earthquakes in Youngstown, Ohio, that have been directly linked, and of course these are not the only earthquakes that have been directly linked to fracking. Youngstown, Ohio is a place that hasn't experienced any earthquakes since at least the founding of the Republic, and records were being kept. Talk about this issue, and does this also affect places like California? I mean, could the earthquakes actually be catastrophic?
Right. Well, yes, earthquakes do accompany hydrofracturing. In the process of completing a well, what happens is the drillers use a perforating gun to poke holes in the well casing so that the water can be forced into the rock to create fractures. Well, the perforating gun uses explosives, and these explosives can trigger earthquakes. So in Oklahoma, for example, a place that's had almost no earthquake activity historically, now there are earthquakes, up to 5-point earthquakes that are directly associated with hydrofracturing. Now, for the most part, these are very, very small earthquakes, imperceptible to most people most of the time. However, in a place like California, where you already have the potential for very large earthquakes, there is the possibility of much smaller earthquakes than setting off much larger events. And so people in California are understandably quite hesitant about applying fracturing in their state.
Gas fracking has, natural gas has been touted as a bridge fuel to a renewable future, as especially President Obama talked about it as being more climate friendly. And yet, as you just mentioned, holes are bored in well casings, and there's been an issue of methane leaks. I saw the film Gasland 2, by Josh Box. Gasland 1 was also about fracking, and the second film is just being released now. He says that that natural gas is not a benefit to climate change.
Right. Well, this is a very controversial point, and studies have come down on both sides of this question. To me, the most persuasive study is that of the National Ocean Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, which they were able to measure the natural gas directly from the air using an airplane with very sophisticated instrumentation. What they found was that between 5% and 10% of the natural gas that was being produced was escaping directly into the atmosphere. Now, the significance of that number is that it's way above the number that would indicate that natural gas is actually a net climate benefit as compared to coal. If 3% or less of the natural gas is escaping, then there's a climate benefit. And the reason for this is, of course, that methane is actually a worse climate culprit than carbon dioxide. A lot less methane goes into the atmosphere than CO2 from industrial processes, but on a pound per pound basis, methane over short term, over a matter of decades, is actually from 20 to 100 times as powerful a greenhouse gas as CO2. So if much of this methane from natural gas production is leaking, then, in fact, it's worse for us than burning coal, and that's what NOAA found.
Well, that's terrifying. But, Richard Heinberg, your book, Snake Oil, also goes into the economic, and we've talked a little bit about them, but I'd like to go much more deeply into some of the economic issues. I mean, the environmental issues are worrisome enough, but economically, you say there are only a few who actually benefit and many who don't. There are claims that the boom in natural gas and in fracking oil is going to bring jobs to typically very depressed areas. How does this bear out? Boom towns like North Dakota or in boom states like North Dakota, what's going to happen with them?
Right. Well, over the short term, there's no question. Fracking brings more economic activity. Now, of course, some people benefit more than others from this. When fracking comes to town, that means a lot of out-of-town workers arrive to drive trucks or to actually do the drilling and completion of wells. So that means that rents go up and price of living goes up. So people on fixed incomes are often forced out of those communities. But then there's the question of how long does this actually last and who gets the jobs? It turns out that this is a pretty short-term phenomenon. Mostly it's 2 to 3 years that the economic boom lasts, and during that time, a lot of the best-paying jobs go to out-of-state workers who fly in, do the technical work, and then fly out again. So for a short time, for a couple of years, hoteliers, restaurateurs see, you know, booming times, and then it's pretty much all over. So the question is it, you know, was it really worth it at the end of the day? You know, the boomtown phenomenon is as old as the oil and gas industry, and there are ghost towns all over the American Southwest that were once thriving communities living off the revenues of oil and gas production, and today is basically nothing there. So, yeah, if that's the kind of economy that we want to aim for, then sure, fracking will give it to us, but I think a lot of us would prefer to see some kind of more sustainable economic base.
There's also many depressed communities in Pennsylvania and upstate New York where gas leases promise money to these communities. Are these false promises as well?
Well, in some cases, yes. Of course, the companies try to avoid paying out on those leases as much as they can, not so much the initial lease payment as the royalties from actual oil or gas production. And this is, you know, this is pretty infuriating, but they find ways of creating shell companies, for example, using one company to actually produce the natural gas, let's say. And then that company sells it to another shell company at, you know, pennies on the dollar for a tiny, tiny fraction of what the gas is actually worth at current market rate. And so the person who's holding the lease, the farmer or the landowner, is paid on the basis of what that initial shell company paid the second shell company for the natural gas. So, you know, the actual payments that are delivered are trivial in comparison with the promise. You know, often these people are promised that they'll become millionaires and so on, and turns out the actual royalty payments are insignificant.
And some of them are finding that their home values are going down because mortgage companies are not willing to actually give mortgages increasingly, or insurance companies to insure houses that are near these fracking wells.
Well, if you've ever been in one of these areas, you know that it's fracking is noisy, it's smelly, it's just a terrible nuisance. Unless you're benefiting directly from it economically or financially in some way, it's just a horrible thing to be around. So if you own land in one of these areas, your property value is going to go down because it's going to be harder for you to sell that land. Nobody's going to want to live near one of these fracking operations or live with the possibility that their water has been contaminated. So, yeah, property values fall. And, you know, companies target low-income areas to start with. And the reason for that is that poor communities need the money that fracking brings. And so people in these communities are much less likely to band together to oppose fracking for environmental reasons. They're much more likely to support fracking, even if it's tainting their water or impairing their health. They're going to support the industry because they need the money.
Richard Heinberg, you also talk about Wall Street and this kind of rip-and-run model that you're talking about with the gas companies and the oil companies extends to the financial businesses of Wall Street. How does Wall Street benefit? What's their role in this bubble that you speak about in snake oil?
Well, all of the companies that are involved in fracking land are highly leveraged. And the reason for that is this is expensive business. A typical well costs $10, $12 million to drill. There are 2,000 tractor-trailer truck trips to bring in the water and the chemicals and hiring personnel. And all it's all just, you know, costly business. And actual production in many cases doesn't cover the costs. This is especially true with natural gas. So the companies make do by raising money through selling shares of stock, by selling off leases, and these are all financial activities that Wall Street benefits from. Wall Street loves to sell shares in these companies, and if the companies don't do so well, then mergers and acquisitions, or Wall Street's happy to help out with that too. So one way or another, the big investment banks benefit from the shale oil and shale gas boom. And we have to be clear here, we're talking about a big boom. Tens and hundreds of billions of dollars have changed hands in the last 2 or 3 years in the massive drilling operations, drillings of tens of thousands of wells, production of millions of barrels of oil and enormous amounts of natural gas. All of this is pretty big business, even though most of the companies that we're talking about are relatively small companies. So Wall Street is viewing this as, you know, the next big thing. This, after the housing boom, the fracking boom is their next big source of revenue. But, you know, what's good for Wall Street is not always good for the rest of the country, and I would argue that's the case here as well.
So is there an issue of these companies, these small companies, being over-leveraged? I mean, is there a debt threat looming here?
Oh, yes, absolutely. They, all of these companies are highly leveraged. To take just the biggest one, Chesapeake, hasn't made in revenue of its sale of natural gas and other produced fuels. It hasn't made enough to cover its costs in a single one of the past 10 years. So it's subsisting entirely on complex financial obligations, derivatives, sales and shares, and in selling leases. Chesapeake was early on in the scene buying leases to millions of acres across Texas and Oklahoma. And in the last few years, Chesapeake has sold some of those leases to companies in China and elsewhere at inflated prices. I mean, everybody wants to get in on the fracking game because they've all heard the hype. They've all heard that this is 100 years of natural gas and that there's no end to it in sight. So, you know, Chesapeake is flush with cash, but they're deeply, deeply in debt.
Wow. Now, one thing we've heard a lot about is how natural gas is a bridge fuel. What about the impact on renewable energy? Is this buying us time until we get to renewables, or is it having a negative impact on renewables?
Well, it's actually having a negative impact on renewables in two ways. First, because of the artificially low, temporarily low price of natural gas, that's putting renewable energy sources at a disadvantage. But in a bigger sense, our energy conversation in this country has changed. Just a few years ago, that conversation was about how are we going to get off of fossil fuels. We know that fossil fuels are depleting non-renewable resources. We know that burning them changes the climate. So it's just a matter of how and how fast we make the transition to renewable energy. Well, with the fracking revolution, that conversation has changed to one of abundance. Now we have all of this natural gas and oil, so we can afford to, you know, let off on the accelerator of change and just kind of enjoy this abundance for a couple of decades, and then we'll think about renewable energy later. That's the energy policy of all of the above in effect. But, you know, we don't have that much time. We've bought ourselves just a very few years, and if we do slow down the transition during those few years, then in the next decade, in the 2020s, where are we going to be? We're going to have much more expensive oil, we're going to have much more expensive natural gas, and production of both fuels will be declining. Meanwhile, we won't have develop the alternative energy sources to see us through. That would really be the worst case scenario, but that's exactly where we're headed right now.
Well, Richard Heinberg, your book is Snake Oil, How Fracking's False Promise Imperils Our Future. I think you've laid out the case very, very clearly. It's a terrific book, and I highly recommend it to all our listeners. Thanks so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
It's been a real pleasure talking with you. Thank you.
Richard Heinberg. You can read an excerpt from Snake Oil by going to writersvoice.net. You can also find a cool video from Heinberg to view and share. Next up, Bill McKibben on oil and honey. Stay tuned after the break. Thank you. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Bill McKibben is a climate hero. In 2009, with just 7 students at Middlebury College where he taught, he started the Global Climate Action Mass Movement with the launching of 350.org. That movement has spread like wildfire, sparking the proliferation of grassroots climate activists everywhere. McKibben's movement has succeeded in putting the building of the Keystone XL pipeline in doubt, a project that would be game over for the planet if allowed to go forward, according to leading climate scientist James Hansen. And it's sparked a new fossil fuel divestment movement based on the one that brought down apartheid in South Africa decades ago. But McKibben is a reluctant activist. A journalist of long standing, he's been writing about climate change and the environment since his 1982 book, The End of Nature. We've talked to him on this show about his books, Earth and Deep Economy. His 2012 article for Rolling Stone, Global Warming's Terrifying New Math, went viral. McKibben is most comfortable writing, teaching, and hanging out at home in rural Vermont with his family and neighbors. But he reached a point where the terrifying math of global warming presented him with a problem. Was he going to continue just writing about the climate crisis, or was he going to do something about it? He decided to take action, and I, for one, feel that humanity is better for it. But he recharges his energy at home and in conversations with his neighbor, master beekeeper Kirk Webster. What McKibben has learned from Webster, the careful husbandry of a species that serves us, respecting its health and well-being, has informed him about the principles we all need to adopt if we are to survive and thrive. Hence, the title of his newest book, Oil and Honey, The Education of an Unlikely Activist. Your book describes two lives, both yours. One was born several years ago when you founded the climate action organization, 350.org. The other was born many years ago when you moved to rural Vermont. I get the sense that these two lives work both in concert with each other and in conflict. Describe them both.
Well, in the book's about, partly, as you say, about my work in the last few years in the climate movement, where it's not that I'm a big leader, but I'm a part of this emerging movement to do something about climate change. And that keeps me on the road more than I would like. The other part of the book is about, it's about one of my neighbors here in Vermont who really exemplifies all that's wonderful about our emerging local food movement and things. He's one of the great beekeepers of the world. And in an age when beehives are dying left and right and things, he manages to have a beautiful chemical-free apiary spread out across the Champlain Valley. So whenever I was home, I had a great time getting to hang out with Kirk and learn about bees, which are interesting creatures.
Yeah, and in fact, you make some analogies. You write about a scientific theory about bee democracy, and you use Kirk Webster, the beekeeper, and his work with bees very much as a kind of metaphor for the work you're doing on climate action.
Well, one of the things that's great about the climate movement that's been building in recent years is that it's really one of the first times that we have this sort of very open source kind of movement that doesn't require, it's not like the civil rights movement in the 1960s where there was, you know, a paramount leader like Dr. King. Instead, it's sort of led by thousands of different nodes all over the country, people doing all and around the world, people doing all kinds of things. And a beehive's kind of that way. There is a queen bee, but the queen bee is not that crucial. The hive, you know, in many ways functions as a unit, and it's beautiful to watch how efficiently and powerfully it happens.
Now, you are a journalist, and the life that you talk about, it was the second life in this book, Oil and Honey, is very much about moving from being a journalist, which you still are, but moving from journalism into activism. You were getting frustrated with the pace of change in the climate movement. What was the catalyst that turned you into an activist?
Well, you know, I wrote the first book about climate change, I guess, about 25 years ago, a book called The End of Nature. And I think at the time, I assumed, and I think most people assumed, that given all this information, given the fact that our finest scientists were trotting up to Capitol Hill every year to explain what was going on, eventually action would happen, that was how our systems work. But that turns out not to be how our system works, at least in this case. The financial power of the fossil fuel industry was so great that it was necessary to try and build some kind of countervailing power. We're not going to outspend Exxon, obviously, so we have to find other currencies to work in, the currencies of movements, passion, spirit, creativity.
Yeah, and you started with just 7 kids at Middlebury College in Vermont with 350.org. It's blossomed into a worldwide movement. Talk about 350.org, the name, the conception, and why you think it took fire.
Well, I think that just there were a lot of people around the country and around the world eager to do something about climate change. The trouble is climate change feels so big that it's not clear that any of us can do anything effective about it as individuals. And so we tend, to sort of ignore it or try to wish it away. But the minute that we were sort of able to suggest that there was political action to be taken on a scale that might actually matter, then there were lots of people ready to go to work.
And were you surprised with how it moved?
I was a little surprised, but not completely, because I knew how I felt about all of this. And I assumed that there were others who were just as worried and scared as I was.
Right. Now, you started out by zeroing in on the Keystone XL pipeline. Why did you choose that issue to launch your climate campaign?
Because the pipeline is very, very important. The tar sands in Canada are one of the largest pools of carbon on Earth. You know, right now the atmosphere is about 400 parts per million carbon dioxide, which is too high already. The Arctic is melting as a result. But if we burned all the oil up in Alberta, that number would go to about 540 parts per million. So, I mean, this is a very big deal. And the president is going to get to make the call about this pipeline himself without having our crazy Congress in the way. So it seemed a really important place to make a stand.
The first demonstration about the Keystone XL pipeline was at the White House when, over a period of a couple of weeks, more than 1,200 people got arrested, including climate scientist James Hansen and you. You say it was a moment when insider environmentalism got taken over by grassroots power. Talk about these two different wings, if you want to call them that.
I think at this point, it's not really that they're different wings, that they're becoming a much more unified movement. You know, the environmental movement had been very professionalized for a number of years, sort of centered in Washington. But I think everybody involved had very much wanted a movement to emerge. And I think it was exciting for them to see it happening. And that now people have jumped on board in a big way. I mean, the Sierra Club, our oldest and most important environmental group, is changing its charter so that it can take part in civil disobedience for the first time in 120 years. That's what happens when people really start to see possibility.
Yeah, and in fact, they just came out with a new report called FAIL, How the Keystone XL Tar Sands Pipeline Flunks the Climate Test, and we'll have a link to that report on our website when we air this interview. But talk about Keystone a little bit more in depth. You tackled the jobs claim. You tackled the claim that it wasn't going to add any new. It was going to go forward no matter what, so that the pipeline, these are the arguments from the other side, that the pipeline won't add anything more to climate change because one way or another, the tar sands are going to get, exploited.
Yeah, no, there were a whole series of arguments that the oil industry used to try and grease the skids, as it were, for this pipeline, but they all turned out not to be true. I mean, there was, oh, it'll create hundreds of thousands of jobs. I mean, by the time people were actually finished looking at it, it was clear that the number of permanent jobs would be less than 100. That's why they want to build pipelines. They don't take many people to run. It was going to help America's energy security, but then it turns out that the oil is going to be sent overseas, you know, on and on and on and on. So we're at the point now where the president has said in his first remarks on all of this that if Keystone increases the amount of carbon in the atmosphere, it won't happen. And that's the right test. And if he follows that test in good faith, then there's no way he can approve this pipeline.
This is very much a book about how and why to build a political movement to stop climate change. You were in a campaign to reach Obama and to hold him to his campaign rhetoric. Do you think you've succeeded?
Well, I guess we'll find out when he makes the decision later this year or next year on this pipeline. I we've done a lot better than anybody thought we were going to do. So that's good, I guess. And I mean, at the time, everybody thought it was a done deal, you know. So I'm glad that at least we've slowed it down. And you know, now we've gone from just playing defense against pipelines to playing offense against the fossil fuel industry, in particular with this big divestment campaign we've got going, which is going very well.
It's fascinating to read, Bill McKibben, in your book, Oil and Honey, just how you learned how to build a movement and how the others that you've worked with have learned to build that, and how you kind of learned to play, I don't know if I want to say that it's a game, but there is a game here, how to exercise political muscle as a grassroots movement against the power of the fossil fuel lobby in Washington. First of all, let's just talk about the political part of it, working to impact Congress, working to impact Obama. What were some of the most important lessons you learned in that?
Well, left to their own devices, they always win because they have all the money. But that it's not impossible to stand up to them because they don't have a lot of public support and they've lost the scientific argument. So if one does the hard work that many thousands of people have done to stand up to them, then there's some chance at least. And that's, you know, it's a lot harder than it should be. I mean, this tar sands is a just horrible idea, the Rube Goldberg machine for producing global warming. I mean, it couldn't be more gross and stupid. And so it shouldn't take lots of people going to jail and things to stop it, but that's what it does take. And it's good that there are people willing to do that.
And the Keystone XL pipeline was being put into just about every kind of legislative bill imaginable in order to pass, and yet you've been able to stave it off. But there was a certain point that you came to where you felt you had to stop playing defense and go on the offense. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, we're not going to stop global warming one pipeline at a time. There's just too many. We've got to oppose every bad project that comes up. But we've also got to try and put the fossil fuel industry on the defensive because it's their political power that keeps us from ever discussing things like a price on carbon that we would need to really get out of the trouble we're in. So our thought was to look around history for places where there have been effective corporate campaigns. And really the last big example in this country was the one against apartheid a generation ago, and the tool that was really effective then was divestment by colleges, universities, cities, churches. And so we launched that last November, and it's really spreading very quickly. There's 380 college campuses where this fight is underway. Six or seven have already divested. You know, the United Church of Christ divested this summer. Seattle, San Francisco, Providence, a lot of cities and towns are divesting. It's fun to watch.
Explain divestment.
Selling your stock in Exxon and Chevron and Mobil and Texaco and BP and whoever else, all the companies that are driving us over this climate cliff.
And you're going after the big institutional divestors.
That's right, because that's where it's most obvious in public what's going on. And our job is not to bankrupt Exxon. That's not possible. at least in the short run. Our job is to politically bankrupt them, and I think we're beginning to make a little progress.
And this has been a hard sell for some colleges. You went to Harvard. Harvard has not agreed to divest yet, although Swarthmore has.
Well, it'll take a few years. It'll take a few years. You know, the apartheid thing, it took 5, 6, 7 years. And the fight's as good as the win. I mean, we want to be telling people over and over and over again the story about the fossil fuel industry and why they've become a rogue industry.
But you did do a presentation, I believe, at Harvard, and you were armed with two very powerful weapons there. One was a report actually that I reported on for CSR Wire called the Aperio Report that had some very interesting data. Tell us about that.
Well, what they found was that if you divested from fossil fuel, your endowment would do better than if you didn't. In fact, there's been a subsequent report funded by the Associated Press that found that a institution with a $1 billion endowment that had divested from fossil fuel 10 years ago would have made an extra $121 million over the last decade. That's pretty good. And the other thing was a letter from one of my people I really admire, a hedge fund billionaire, a guy named Tom Steyer, who since has quit his hedge fund job to go and work full time against climate change. And what he said was, look, colleges would be very smart to get out now because it's clear that there's this carbon bubble. These guys are planning to burn more carbon than scientists say we can. And so it's just like the housing bubble. You'd rather get out ahead of it than behind it.
Now, how does that work? I mean, the oil prices are at an all-time high. The oil companies are raking in billions.
Yeah, the fossil fuel industry just isn't that good an investment. You know, the coal industry is tanking fast. You know, so we're seeing that there are far better things to invest in, quite aside from the morality of it all.
They talk about stranded assets.
Yeah, exactly right. You know, they've got five times as much coal and gas and oil underground as we can afford to burn. And so 80% of their value really is illusory, at least if we're planning to do anything on climate change.
Some of this came out, the figure you just mentioned came out in an article that you wrote for Rolling Stone that went viral. I think you had something like 100,000 likes on Facebook, some amazing amount. It's called Global Warming's Terrifying New Math. Maybe just briefly, tell us what are the three most important numbers we need to know.
So the numbers in that case were 2 degrees. That's what the world scientists have said is the most that we could get away with raising the temperature. It's probably too high a number since 1 degree, which is what we've raised the temperature so far, has melted the Arctic. We're pretty foolish to find out what 2 degrees will do. But that's the one thing that all the world's governments, including the U.S., have agreed on. The second number comes from scientists looking carefully at this, and they've concluded that we could burn about 500 billion tons more carbon and have some hope of staying below 2 degrees. That's our budget, as it were. The third number, and the most depressing one, comes from a team of financial analysts in the U.K., who looked at all the reserves, coal and gas and oil, that the fossil fuel industry has around the world. And they found that it added up to about 2,800 gigatons, or more than five times as much as we could afford to burn. That's not good news. That's coal and gas and oil. They've announced plans to bring to the surface and burn. That's what their share price is based on. That's what they borrow money against. So unless we can change things very quickly here, the end of this story, I'm afraid, is written.
Right. And you also bring in this book, Oil and Honey, Bill McKibben, you bring things down very much to the personal. During the first Keystone XL protests at the White House, Hurricane Irene happened, and it hammered your home state.
Yes, that's right. It's the greatest natural disaster in Vermont's history, if you want to call it a natural disaster. It was astonishing to see what happened when more rain than we've ever seen dropped on on this state, the kind of rain we can have now, because we have as warm air holds more water vapor than cold. So that water just poured down, and it streamed down our hillsides and into our rivers and washed away our roads and bridges. And it was a potent reminder that even in a place like Vermont, where we're trying to do what we can to build a self-reliant local economy and things, that we're still dependent on getting the global part of this right, too. There are no islands anymore, I'm afraid. They don't call it global warming for nothing.
Mm-hmm. And Kirk Webster, the beekeeper, what's his perspective on climate change? How has he seen it operating in his work?
Well, Kirk has seen the weather get stranger and stranger. There's no kind of dependable weather for farmers anymore. And, you know, of course, there are other big problems for beekeepers in an industrialized world. The rapid spread of pesticides that seem to be killing bees en masse, that kind of thing. All of it makes it very hard. But Kirk is an example of the kind of care and vigilance that it's going to take, and the kind of small scale attention to things that it's going to take if we're going to deal with this utterly altered world that we've created.
You end the book, Oil and Honey, at the February rally in 2013 in Washington, D.C. It was a climate change rally. 50,000 people were there. I was one of them with my son and my granddaughter. I know I was incredibly jazzed and surprised to see so many people. What did you feel when you looked out over the crowd?
When I got up on the stage and looked out over the crowd, I just, you know, I blurted out what I was thinking, which was just, I've waited my whole life to see a climate movement develop, and now it finally has. It was very, very beautiful to see.
And I also found it, what was beautiful was, the speeches were amazing. The range of people were coming to talk from the indigenous peoples from Canada who are fighting the Keystone XL pipeline right there. It was a very diverse speaker platform. Can you talk a little bit about how this movement is bringing people together from different streams of grassroots movements?
Yes, it's not exactly a leaderless movement. I'd say more it's like a leaderful movement, you know. There are people all over the place who are really driving the momentum of this campaign. And it's really fun to watch that happen. The indigenous communities really started things off. They were the first champions of all this work, and they're really in the forefront still. Farmers and ranchers in Nebraska, urban people from organized by groups like the Hip Hop Caucus, you know, scientists, of course, religious leaders. What fun just to see everybody engaged and involved.
Mm. And I guess the question that you get asked a lot, and I think I've even asked you on previous interviews that we've done, but it's good to take the temperature each time. How about your sense of hope that we can actually do this thing in time?
Well, you know, I don't spend an enormous amount of time, Francesca, trying to decide if I'm optimistic or pessimistic. I get up in the morning and do what I can to help. The science is very dark. It's not a good sign that the Arctic melted. On the other hand, it's very exciting to see the movement finally forming. I guess it feels like a race, you know, and we're finally in the race and racing. So let's hope that things go well from here and we catch a break or two.
Yeah. Well, Bill McKibben, a lot of that is due to the work that you and so many hundreds of thousands of other people are doing, but you've been a tremendous leader on this, and I want to thank you so much for talking with us here and for doing that work.
Always a pleasure to talk with you, and thank you for your good work.
Bill McKibben.
That's it this week
from
writersvoice.net.
Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. Our webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.